This is Icon Art Radio. I'm Bill Teepel, and I'm here with my co-host, Alan Cobb. And today's guest is Jillian Brown, professor of art at the Art School of MUM here in Fairfield. You probably know, I'm the director of Icon Gallery. And we're going to have a show of Jillian's work, and we're going to call her Jill from now on, at Icon, opening on December 7th, I believe, 2012, if you're listening to this as a repeat in the future, continuing through January. And I'm looking so forward to the show. I can't wait to see it in the gallery. I have already seen glimpses of it in her studio, and I'm very excited. I'll have to say that you are one of my favorites.
Thank you, Bill.
Well, I second the motion on that. You were one of the first artists I saw in Fairfield at the Gallery 51 East location in the upper regions of Fairfield.
It was some time ago, wasn't it?
It was a long time ago, yeah. Well, but I loved what you were doing. It was, you had video things projecting through things and hands and some...
Yes.
You had the flying seagull video appeared there for the first time, for me anyway.
And I kept doing those for a few years.
Mm-hmm.
But in the last couple of years, I stopped doing video and have been doing more two-dimensional pieces.
Uh-huh.
We'll see if they work.
Yeah,
but they're not unlike what you had been doing a decade or more ago, is that right?
Yeah.
Or even, when did you first do these encaustic pieces?
Oh, the encaustic pieces, maybe a decade ago.
Because I know we included one or
two
in the grand opening.
There was
a
blackboard.
Which was Gallery 51 East at that time. But that, we're talking about 11 or 12 years ago.
Yeah, pretty amazing.
Yeah.
But the thing about your work is some of the images are some of my favorite images in my head.
Mm-hmm.
You are,
well, there's something about it that is, at first glance, I can tell there's something going on that interests me. And there's an awful lot of art that has, you know, more than enough content to be totally valid, whether I like it or not. But it doesn't catch my attention at all.
Mm-hmm.
And your stuff always gets my attention. I always think, oh, man, what is that? What's going on here? And it's great.
Well, they're aesthetically great.
Yeah,
But there's also layered levels of meaning and multidimensional queries. And there's a lot going on there. But on the level of my quiet appreciation of kind of a minimalist, zen kind of art, it delivers on that level too. So
mm-hmm.
we're your fans here.
Yeah, you're
complimented. The background was photography, and that tends to be what I teach. And the layered pieces started, when would it be? I don't know, maybe in the 90s.
Although
it's hard to say, you know? I feel like early on, the influences were definitely conceptual, and the photography that I cared about was a kind of anti-aesthetic documentation of conceptual pieces. You know, those were my big influences from the 70s. But then I started making these three-dimensional works that I set up in order to be photographed, but the setups looked more interesting than the pieces. So I would show them as both photographs and pieces, and somehow those ended up being layered, really. You know, I hadn't thought of them as layered, but these paintings that I would paint in corners. So then you'd both have this corner, you know, which was really a plain corner, except for my painting in it, which made it look like there would be a reconstituted little black and white photograph blown up huge. So that was a kind of layering. But then sometime after that, I was doing, maybe influenced by looking at some pieces by Esther Parada, who was a Chicago and national artist. I started doing these pieces in the darkroom that looked like mine looked like blackboards, you know, and I had often been using motifs from the classroom because I was interested in ideas about representation and more generally ideas about how we know things. It sounds so basic and simple in its way, and it's sort of a common thing to think about, I think. But if I was thinking about how we know things, then I could use the classroom as sort of a iconography of, I don't know, indoctrination or in the forming of the brain. And so I wanted to do these pieces that had multiple layers in the darkroom of children and of blackboard motifs. And I did a whole series of those. And this was really pre-Photoshop, although, you know, this layering that artists were doing in general, certainly I was picking it up from art in general, that there was a lot of layering going on, must have been happening side by side with Photoshop being developed. You know, the artists wanted this, the Adobe developed it. And, you know, eventually it probably seemed like maybe I could have done it on the computer. I don't know, they're so much prettier in the darkroom. But I turned those into large airbrushed paintings, which could look sort of like multiply exposed pieces done in the darkroom. But it freed me of the darkroom and let me get bigger. Well, anyway, that's old work. I'm not sure where it came from.
They hold.
Yeah, thank you. And I guess I mentioned it because you said that you liked the content. And, you know, I care a lot about recognizable imagery and about content and about blending content. And my kind of, you know, I guess symbols or whatever tend to refer to models of knowledge.
Well, the thing that always really struck me about the ones at Gallery 51, which did look like blackboards, was, and in fact, I was tempted to assume they were blackboards. I didn't really analyze them any further. But what I liked about it was the idea of all the latency on a blackboard. You know, you write on a blackboard, and then you erase it, but it's still there, and then you write something else or draw something and erase that, and then they're both still there, kind of. And it's like a visual analog to reverberation. You know, the tail of the sound is still fading away after you stop saying it.
And I thought of it as a visual analog of mental processes.
Right.
Mm-hmm. You know,
forgetting,
erasure, remembering things coming up and being associated that don't really make sense except somehow your brain did it.
Yeah, there they are. Right.
But I like what you're saying.
And it's also why I like the black. Well, the blackboard is like the field. And there's all this stuff floating in and out and erasing and coming in and going. Mm-hmm. But there's also the blackness is like the mind, kind of. Like whatever color is going on in the mind, those blackboard paintings, I didn't think of them as black. I thought it was more like imagery in the mind. So that I sort of liked that.
Yeah.
Oh, that's nice. A colorist I am not.
No. Well, you're subtle. You're doing subtle color right
now.
Yeah. You'll see.
Yeah, deeply subtle.
I always... Well, go ahead.
Well, it was a big breakthrough once when I think I put a little bit of red on a Mickey Mouse in one of the blackboards.
Well, we always wonder what... I mean, there's vivid dreaming. You know, we have vivid colors, obviously, but there's this other vague place where you're not quite sure what color dreams actually are.
Yeah, a lot of my dreams are kind of black and white. I mean, if they have color, the color isn't noticed or of any import.
Yeah.
And
so this blackboard thing was such a nice metaphor.
It's a fabulous
metaphor. All that goes on in the mind.
Well, but the video, the flight thing, it's the same thing because you're getting these video trails.
Doing the same thing on the...
Yeah, particularly some of the videos more than others. But I had been dear friends with Inga, who just moved to town, for a long time. We'd been next door neighbors in our studios, and we're kind of influential of each other, and we started showing together. We started showing blackboard-looking pieces together. But then Inga joined a digital program at UMBC Baltimore, And I sort of joined her for her MFA. I mean, it was just, I went in and learned After Effects. And After Effects is just like Photoshop, except it's with video clips.
Yeah, exactly.
So you can, it's got that layering. So we did some layered pieces together. They were sort of co-authored pieces that were for her BFA show, and we did a group of them in their large room size projected pieces. And then I started doing these small sculptures, like maybe body sized or something sculptures, that involved layers of translucent material making up the sculpture. And I would use single projectors, and the projector would hit different surfaces. So they would have their rather different form of layering. And then more recently, I just kind of drew back. I think I got, oh, who knows? I wanted something. There were things happening in my life. I wanted something simple. I wanted something that, although I miss, I would love to finish another video, but that's not happening right now. I think I got a little sick of the equipment. And I just started falling in love with little images and doing two-dimensional little paintings. And prior to that, I had, and probably after the blackboard paintings, I'd done those small-scale encaustic layered pieces. So that was kind of a reference for me of what to go back to if I wanted something small, something I could, you know, do in a corner as opposed to a big space. And then I did a whole bunch of them, well, relatively whole bunch, in the last 6 months. That I think they seem to be holding together. I didn't worry about that. For a while, a friend said, well, why don't you start out with six, you know, canvases or pieces of paper that are all the same size? And I thought, yeah, that's what you're supposed to do for a show. But I've never been able to do that. So I did one this size and another that size, and I didn't think they were linked. But I have a little bit of just plain trust that, okay, I'll do whatever I want, and they're linked in a way that is not just lazy. They'll end up feeling linked because I produce them out of the same set of concerns without meaning to.
They're distinctly linked.
I know.
Conceptually,
I know.
And visually. So the size is sort of, I mean, that's just, it just doesn't matter.
Yeah, I know.
Because you, the intuitive steps you were taking to move from one to another link them.
Yeah, it wasn't obvious when I was making them, but it became more obvious as I got a few of them, which was a big relief. You know, for a little while I thought I would embarrass myself with a crummy show, but now I feel like, well, I like the work okay.
And that isn't that what it comes down to, really, you pleasing yourself? For whatever reasons we please ourselves as artists.
Well, of course, on the other hand, if we're going to make it public, we don't want everybody to hate it.
Well, but
it's
if you're
discouraging.
Happy, yeah, but you know, you can't really, you know, worry
Hold
too
on.
Much if you like it. Now, there's a couple of in your work that interest me.
Yes.
It was in the video projection pieces, it seemed like you were dealing with and asking questions of the miracle of creation.
Mm-hmm.
That it, where does it come from? How does it happen? What? How can you know that? I always,
mm-hmm.
you know, I thought that you'd play with that and you'd bring it to our attention. You'd make us address that.
Mm-hmm.
And with the smoke rings and the
yeah.
different things.
It happens.
The things emerging, and it's like you've been dealing with this emerging from the field, and then you draw the attention kind of to the field itself and the miracle of it. I love that in your work.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, and it. I mean, there are some favorite pieces that I've had that don't really look so much like my work, but, I mean, they don't. Or rather, that wouldn't be the way to put it. My work doesn't look like these famous pieces. But like James Turrell, everybody should see his piece in Des Moines. That, you know, these things that make the play between the perceptual and the physical.
Yeah.
And when I was doing the blackboards, it became obvious that I was interested. Well, no, it was before that. It was these things that Inga and I were doing. It was really our source of commonality, that we were interested in how perception comes into being from not being. You know, at what point does something become background to foreground in terms of our perceptual our perceptual apparatus, or our brain recognition of something being something? And we did a piece where we photographed figures in motion against a white wall, and then we so blurred it and slowed it down into this piece that filled a room, that and that at first you just thought you were looking at aberrations in the lighting, and then you started to sort of see, no, maybe that's a figure, or no, maybe it's just crummy lighting. So that sort of relates to my admiration of Terrell, that in between, you know, when, and actually I love misperception, you know, and
yeah.
Inga and I actually shared a fellowship at Harvard, and I got to be friends prior to that with somebody who was one of the perceptual people in the psych department at Harvard, and he would bring me in and show me all the, you know, what they are is they're little devices that point out our perceptual bugs, you know, all the things that don't work.
Yeah.
And, you know, it's kind of a delightful place
That's
to be.
That's fantastic.
Yeah, it was really fun.
I mean, the boundary between what's real and what's not real is just a whole gray area that's really doesn't end on the real side at all. I mean, there is nothing that's real
and
that doesn't have distortions and interpretations and, you know, strange gaps and blind spots and things.
And it's a kind of common interest,
mm-hmm.
I think, you know, that
yeah.
and has become common, say, in the last 50 years, and is enhanced by people's work in cognitive sciences.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, it's rich and fun, and that was a source of commonality between Inga and I. And then certainly one of the things that I would bring into it were my experiences with meditating. That, you know, those kind of delicious moments where you get to experience the kind, you know, something that feels like it's in between nothing and something.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. And then there's physics, you know, this famous question, which I just heard was first introduced by Leibniz, who I don't know anything about. I just only know this. The why is there something instead of nothing? It's a, you know, the famous contemporary physicists will say that. Why is there something instead of nothing? You know, and of course I'm not looking at physics, nor can I get it really, but, you know, I'm looking at it perceptually.
Yeah. Well, that's a common thread that goes all the way back to, you know, the earliest ages of philosophy in all civilizations.
Yeah.
Why is there anything? You know, you try to define stuff and you end up having to define being. And defining being is
why is there
just
non-being?
About impossible. Yeah, I mean, what isn't and what is. I'm reading a book now called On Being and What There Is.
I just bought my husband a book, whereby he goes to various physicists and metaphysicists. Who is it? Oh, darn, I know him. Jim Holt. I think writes for the New Yorker. Anyway, it's him going to all these people and saying, asking them why there's something instead of nothing.
Yeah.
I think it's juicy.
Yeah.
I mean, I think it's going to be juicy.
Yeah, sounds great. It's a fundamental question. That's the, what was it, I forget the philosopher who basically said that, he was talking about dread, Dasein, the dread of obliteration or annihilation or non-existence as a kind of universal experience that's underlying things somewhere at some level. And sometimes people confront it and it can be the dark night of the soul. But he also made the point, I think it was maybe Wittgenstein, he made the point that this fear of the loss of everything may be, for many people, if not most people, their first opportunity to experience anything that relates to the concept of everything. So a fear of the loss of everything is a strange negative way of turning your attention towards the concept of everything. And before that, you can't even imagine everything. But when you fear the loss of it all, then the thing you're fearing the loss of is the thing.
That's really nice.
It's a cool concept.
I'm going to insert here for those who have just tuned in. They got in their car and started driving down the street. That this is Icon Art Radio on KRUU FM 100.1, and we're interviewing. I'm not Alan Cobb. I'm with my co-host Alan Cobb. I'm Bill Tipo, director of Icon Gallery, and we're interviewing Jillian Brown, whose show is opening at Icon in December 2012. So we've got the addressing of the why of it all. This work that you're doing is drawing a lot of imagery from notebooks and geometry of Euclid, and you've got the Pythagoras. Isn't Pythagoras in there too? So this has to do with, like, after it all comes about, the mathematical perfection of things. That seems to be something that appeals to you. What is your attraction to Euclid and Pythagoras?
Yeah, you know, it's going to sound so haphazard, and maybe even like a kind of curious misdirection in the beginning. But Madeline and I went to India together. And
I'll just mention that Madeline DiJolie is also...
Oh, we're having the show together. It's
here.
Our show.
Yeah, right. You're not working on the same objects together, but you will both have...
But we thought we might. That we might use as a starting point these gorgeous niches, triangular niches that are in the walls of the temples and the houses and everywhere, and are used as little, little places to burn kumkum or have little teeny, well, maybe not. They're probably for little burning things, incense. And Madeline noticed them in particular, and they're beautiful. And she photographed them. I photographed them some with her camera. And so we thought, well, maybe we'll do, and then I took some video, this video of, you know, about a couple hundred lines of lingams in a particular temple. That, you know, we sort of thought maybe we'd try to do something with projected video and the niches and the triangular niches. And so then I had an idea that, you know, this was going to make our work cohere, not that it doesn't cohere anyway in other ways, but... we were going to work on these independently of these triangles, and I hope we do it after the show, but it didn't happen. And instead, I ended up looking up Euclid, and I found this 9th century, this is what you get in the internet now, Cambridge University, everybody's digitizing these gorgeous old manuscripts.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So I have a 9th century, but there are others that you can find, like a Vatican one, but there's a 9th century copy of Euclid in Greek, and I fell in love with the book. I actually I kind of like Euclid, so you
what's
know
not to like.
But I mean, so it's a little bit conceptually, you know. Geometry in high school was an aesthetic experience for me, and I would talk about it with my best friends. You know, we'd talk about lines, and, you know, it's kind of a sweet thing to remember.
Mm-hmm.
My homage to Kathy Dunn, in case I ever send her this. And there are things that I've found out over time. Well, you know, I just use math in a bunch of the work as a symbol for something that's primordial. You know, it's like the laws of nature or something. You know, I just use it like that. And usually I have really faded numbers, so you get that. And I've made a lot of references to some pretty basic things in math because I don't remember much more than the basic or the more basic stuff. And so anyway, I fell in love with the Euclid stuff, and I'd already known things like, you know, there was Pythagoras, you know, he's Greek, so I don't know what does that mean. He was probably 500 BC or something, 300 BC.
Like
so he was
century.
Pardon?
Yeah, 500 BC.
Mm, 500 BC.
Okay, so 500 BC was the first good guess, and so he's really early, and Euclid, just incidentally, is famous not really so much for working that sort of thing out, but by making a formal proof. It's a whole other level of interest, I guess. But it's not like Pythagoras is the only one who came up with that little formula. The Greeks had a way, the Chinese, of course, have this really gorgeous thing that, anyway, so it's very cross-cultural, and the same formula would come up in different cultures across the world and at different times, and, you know, it makes it feel universal. So when I fell in love with this book by Euclid, I just started using it as imagery.
Geometry is the one thing that I could connect with mathematically.
Yeah, I loved
math
geometry.
It wasn't exactly my forte.
Yeah.
I did okay, but the geometry is something went off for me. And it was because I was an artist, and all of these perfections of all these things working visually.
Well, and the stuff they were trying to teach, and it's in plain geometry class, was stuff that to me was just visually obvious. It wasn't like math at all.
Right.
It was not figuring or calculating. And I learned later that that's not what math is. Anyway, calculating is like one dusty corner of mathematics.
It was visually obvious, but the trick was is you had to follow the formulas and get to the
QED.
Well,
you had to see what's the procedure. How can you actually prove that these angles are equal and stuff? But the proof is visual. It's not like a formula. It's not remembering how to do binomial expansion on an equation or something. I use that as an example. It's like I'm not inspired by that. But I later in life I met a mathematician and we became really good friends, and we spent long hours talking about foundation theory, and that I loved.
Yeah.
Because it's nothing like the math. It's not algebra. It doesn't have anything to do with algebra or calculus. It's a completely different world.
And I'm married to somebody who started out as a mathematician and ended up as a computer scientist. So we play off of each other. And my goodness, we're coming to an end now.
Yes,
it's been so great to have you. I think we're going to have a show with you and Madeline talking about the show. So thank you.
Thank you.
You've been listening to Icon Art Radio, a production of Iowa Contemporary Art, Fairfield.